What's up, everyone, and welcome to my personal podcast. And this is the inaugural episode. And I thought, why don't we just start off with a bang with one of the most accomplished coaches of all time in European history, Coach Ettore Messina. I'm very proud to be able to call him my friend and mentor. And we had a long but very nice and very informative conversation about his coaching path, about the lessons he learned from it, the communication that he uses in his staff and the expectations he has from them, and much, much more. It was a mammoth-length conversation, so don't rush through it. You don't have to listen to all at once. Take your time, get your pen and paper out, and take some notes, and just enjoy. Afterwards, if you have time, please subscribe to this podcast, whether it's on a YouTube channel or on this platform that you're listening to on this audio version. Also, you can rate this episode. Just basically just go to town on my podcast, whether it's rating, subscribing, whatever you want to do. It was not my best performance per se on this podcast, so please excuse me, but I tend to be more self-critical than others would be with me. So take your time, please enjoy, and here we go. We're rolling right now. Coach, thanks for being on my first podcast and inaugural episode with my man, Ettore Messina.
Great honor. You're a friend, you're a great coach. I'm very, very happy to join you today. Hopefully somebody besides my mom, my wife, and your parents will listen to us.
Well, I hope so. You know, in college, I studied communication, and the first thing I learned in a speech class was that it's very important to have an attention getter, a good attention getter. And I have no doubt that this is it. So I think there will be more people listening.
Hopefully.
So on a serious note, though, I appreciate your trust in me. I'm a rookie with this, and I don't take it for granted. So thanks for taking the chance on that. Before we dive into it, you know, the year 2020 was a very special year for every one of us, and I would like to just have a short recap of what it meant to you, what perspective it provided apart from basketball in terms of life.
One positive and one negative immediately jumped to my mind. The positive one was that because we were declared a red zone, all Italy, Milano, all the region of Lombardia, that, as you know, was hit extremely hard in the first wave of the virus. That gave me, my wife, my son, and my daughter the opportunity to live together for a couple of months. And, together, what I mean together, you well know, because it's been like this for a lot of people. From the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed, you know, share the same space, meals, conversations, watch a movie together, play a table game like Monopoly, or do homework, fitness, you know, just to stay in shape together. It's been an amazing time, and this is on the positive one. The other one I will never forget. The horns of the ambulances rushing to the hospitals. We live close to one of the biggest hospitals in Milano, and it's been really, really hard to witness that. And the other thing, the lines of people seeking for meals in these organization charities places where they were feeding a lot of people that have lost jobs, that have lost the opportunity to just eat, just have a proper meal. It's hard. It's hard for a lot of people. Hopefully, we'll come out soon. But still, I think that the sense of togetherness and the being available to help people, unfortunately, is not being enough. We had the first weeks where the sense of let's do it together, let's overcome this together, this is a war, we got to stick together, was a very strong feel. And then immediately after those first weeks, too many selfish behaviors, too many people who forgot that we were in emergency and we need to be extremely disciplined. So positive and negative things that unfortunately are the mirror of who we are as people, how is the human being? Nothing new, unfortunately, but everybody was hoping probably that the emergency was going to pull the best out of us. And that happened for a little while, and then we became again individuals. And that's not for people like you and I, who've been living all life trying to put people together in order to become teams. I don't think we've done enough good job in becoming teams. That's just my feel.
Well, that little part of hope still remains, because for a little bit we could keep it together and get it together. So I remain optimistic, because it gave us a sense of reflection. And when you go through these ups and downs, you're still able to show some gratitude for the situation you're in. I at least am able to, because I was reflecting a lot. And I think that this time gave all of us a time of reflection. And I think those people that reverted back to who they were, I think at some point they will catch up to the right behavior. So I remain optimistic, because for a short period, if at least you can do it, and that means that in the long term you should be able to revert to that as well.
Well, the good thing is that those who are young as you are remain optimistic, and that gives us, I think, the strength to go forward. I think the young generations have been showing on one side a little bit too much of undiscipline with their desire of stay together, of keep going out, keep entertaining relationship. But on the other end, there's been a lot of energy, of positive energy from young people. So that's something that we cannot underestimate.
Well, the singing from the balconies went around the world in Italy. So that energy, we should take that and run with it. So
hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. Yeah. Let's do it. So I broke down this podcast in four quarters, as you can expect. I like to break down games. So the first quarter would be the beginnings of your journey. And allow me to skip over the achievements and the trophies and the particular parts of history with respect to it. May they rest in peace, but they're still in all of our memories. But I would like to go into more practical and applicable things to the up-and-coming coaches and the basketball community in general.
Sure.
The coaching, you pick coaching, and it's the hardest profession in the world. Most coaches would agree. And people, next to being a president or anything of that nature, because it requires a big capacity of handling different situations. But how did you go about choosing coaching? Where was the beginning, the first steps? And my research says that you don't come from a basketball family, so it was not automatically assumed that you would be a basketball savant. So where did that start? And a follow-up question would be that we can get into afterwards is Renato Dianello, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, was the first.
Dianello. So He's the man.
So let's talk about the first part.
Yeah, first of all, as you correctly said, my family, not a sport family. My father was a lawyer. My mom, an housewife. And awkwardly, I became a coach. And my late brother was an international athlete of karate for Italy. He competed in the Worlds. He competed in the European Championship. He was a black belt. Whatever done he was. So both of us were in sport, for all our life. And that's pretty funny. I grew up in Mestre and Venice. Mestre is the land part of Venice, not on the sea. Mm-hmm. Both small cities, a little bit like San Francisco and Oakland, let's say, they're separate from the bridge. And both cities, for whatever reason, were full of playgrounds. Especially Venice, impossible to find soccer fields, too big, not enough space. But in all churches and all schools, there were basketball playgrounds. So I started playing basketball when I was 12 or 11 in school. And then I moved to play basketball in the youth program of Reyer Venezia. Reyer Venezia now is still the current champion of Italy, and he's playing in the Champions League, in the Euro Cup, I'm sorry. And, you know, back then, it was probably one of the top five teams in Italy after Milano, Varese, and Bologna. And the head coach of the team was my physical education teacher in school. And so, you know, basketball was pretty big. So I made it to their youth program, and I had this wonderful coach, Renato Vianello, who, like it always happens in life, you meet somebody who, with this behavior, with this enthusiasm, with this knowledge, inspires you. So to see this coach coming every day to practice, dressed like a coach, with his practice plan, and always teaching, always pushing us, always giving us the opportunity to talk to him, always encouraging us. And back then, all these coaches were doing basketball as a second job. Even the head coach of the club, who was doing physical education teacher, because back then nobody could make a living out of basketball. So, you know, I started being attracted by this personality. And I loved playing. I could play hours and hours and hours, even in the winter, outdoor with all my friends. But to see this, how they were running the team and putting and helping us to get together and play hard, it was something that really hit me since when I was 15, 16, 17. So at some point, I was not going to be a high-level player. And this idea to become a little bit of a coach was, you know, a little bit here, a bug in my mind. And I started helping with the younger kids, 11 years old, 12 years old, going to the gym. And, you know, before my practice, I was helping the coaches with these young players. So long story short, the last year I played, I was 17. We were in the final, in the regional final, playing home. At buzzer expires, we were tied. They ran a play for me. I get fouled. I go to the line. I was a good, very good foul shooter, but for whatever reason, I felt the emotion. I missed both free throws, and we lose. Okay. The day after, the head coach calls me in his office in school. So not Renato Vianello. He calls me in his office. I go there, and he gives me a shampoo, telling me how I messed up everything up because I didn't follow the by my legs. I was shitting my pants and blind, 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 blind. I was really down. So at the end of all this, he says, listen, you're not going to be a player flat like that. But I saw you in the gym with the young kids. I think you could become a good coach. So if you want to quit, and listen to this, I was 17. If you want to stop playing, we'll help you with your education. I think like in Lithuania and most countries in Europe, you have to go through an education to get a coach's license, you know, and there are all different steps. You do that in years. So I said, we're going to help you. We're going to pay for your education. You can start coaching our youth teams next year. And if you think about that's crazy. And all my life has been marked by people who saw something in me that I could not even think and gave me an opportunity where probably if I were in their shoes, I would have not given myself an opportunity. So this guy gave me an opportunity to start coaching when I was 17. And when I was 23, I became an assistant coach in Bologna, in Virtus Bologna. And when I was 29, they offered me the job as a head coach. And when I was 33, somebody else, the president of the federation, offered me to become the national coach of Italy. So all these people gave me opportunities. And I was lucky because of that, because I think, and I experienced that personally, you can be very good, you can study everything, you can have all your diplomas or degrees, you can be the smartest in the world, but if you don't find somebody, if you don't meet somebody that give you an opportunity, you will never grow awesome or develop into anything. And there are a lot of people, I'm fully aware of this, and I really believe this. There are a lot of people that are very capable, and they never shine because nobody gives them an opportunity. And that's why I think, getting older, I think one of my responsibilities, having had success, is to, if I find somebody who deserves an opportunity, find a way to give him that opportunity, whether he's a player or a young coach or a manager or whatever it is. As long as I am in position to do it, I feel that that's my responsibility, because that's what people did for me.
I can relate to that fully, because I would not have been, I would not be here now if Kozlauskas would not have given me the opportunity to work at CSKA and then with the national team. Then, as you say, it's also on the person to use that opportunity to work through it. But opening up the door, it has to do with luck. You have to have a lucky break, and you have to have somebody pushing you to give you that opportunity to show yourself and show your talent. And if you don't have it, you don't have it. But that lucky break is means a lot, and not many people get it. I totally agree. And I will get back to Renato later on, because one thing how you described is how I wanted to end this podcast, but we're not there yet. I wanted to also first of all talk about the transition from becoming an assistant coach at the professional level, and the areas that you struggled with the most early on. What were some of the things that you had to learn on the fly, learn quickly? And the main questions you asked your mentors, I imagine Renato was one of the guys that you asked for help or some guidance that would help you to adjust quicker.
It's a little bit of a complicated question. It's interesting because I started doing youth basketball. So I had my team. My team or my teams. And that goes 4 years in Venice, and then it's 2 more years in Mestre. Back then in Mestre, the crosstown rival, they had an amazing youth program. So one day they basically pulled me out from Venice to go to them. It's like going from, forgive me, Duke to North Carolina or vice versa, or Lietuvos. Yeah. Ritas to Žalgiris or vice versa. But, you know, that was a growth, in my opinion, because their youth program was better than the one in us, okay? So, and I was just, on the other neighborhood. So it was a great opportunity. So overall, I'm already doing 6 years coaching young players. Two teams every day, boom, 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 boom. Now, all of a sudden, the head coach of Mestre, back then Mestre, so figure that in the same city, we had two teams in the pro division, okay? So the head coach there in Mestre, after 2 years I'm there, moves to become the head coach in A2 in Udine, where, just to give an idea, players like Praja Dalipagic or Sven Nader played through the years, you know? Or a guy named Jim McDaniels back then. So a lot of good tradition city. And he asked me to become his assistant. Back then, only one assistant. So from 6 years, where I've been always a head coach, even in a small world of a youth team, I become an assistant. And I had no clue what an assistant should be. And so my strength probably to do individual, the players development. So teach the players. So in the morning, I was doing all my players development. Strategically, I don't think I was that much of a great helper in my first years because, you know, one thing is, so I needed to focus a lot on that. And the biggest adjustment has always been, even when I became an assistant to Coach Pop, which I think is the highest rank of the assistant coaching jobs. You know, when you listen to a genius of our profession, is to try to understand how your head coach thinks and try to learn to think like him. And that's very simple, because so now if you manage to do that and put yourself in his shoes, now you can understand how he's thinking and you become better at the kind of suggestion you can provide and the way you provide a suggestion and the way you help him counteracting his mood. Bottom line, he's depressed, you got to be fired up. He's overexcited, you gotta be calm just to bring him back to earth. All head coaches, we there are moments that we are overexcited because we play very well and we think we're unbeatable. And sometimes we think we're the worst team in the world. The players are the worst. I'm the worst. So I don't care who you are. In that profession, there are moments you need to be cheered up and moments you need to be calmed down and brought back to earth, you know? And so to do that to do it in the right way, you need to understand how your head coach is thinking. And that's very difficult. And you need that. That's, I think, the biggest adjustment. Finally, and it's a little bit hilarious because I was at the youth level, but I was a head coach. So I was thinking, and at the end, I was taking the final decision. So all of a sudden, you don't take any final decision. So, you know, that's hard. That's human. I don't care how humble you are, and you should be, but there's got to be a little part of you that, you know, has a hard time for you not taking the final decision. Otherwise you are Mother Therese from Calcutta, and which is not the truth. And so to handle that kind of inner, you know, desire to take the decision and be, of course, respectful and supportive and straightforward. It's not easy. It's not easy. I always say to my assistants, worst job in the world to be an assistant. I respect being and I've been lucky that in my life, at one point of my life, I had the opportunity to go back and be an assistant because, you know, it's not easy to be an assistant, but that makes you think. And makes you a better. I understand why now I understand why in the NBA is so common that unless you are Greg Popovich or Doc Rivers or whatever you are, that are for the majority of the coaches, it's very normal to be a head coach and then you get back to being an assistant for a while and then you're back to being a head coach again. Why? Because that makes you better.
Yeah.
And in Europe, for whatever reason, you're an assistant. You can be an assistant for all your life, or you are a head coach for all your life. And there is too much difference, I think, in the consideration that we have towards head coaches and assistants.
I'm sure there's a lot of strange dynamics that are going on between the shifts of those roles. And in the NBA, like you said, it's much more natural to shift between those two positions. And I'm sure there's a lot of humbling also going on in terms of, you know, putting your ego in check in certain situations where, like you said, you know, you have to know when to say something, when you have to shut up, and when you have to also take the role with how to talk to players and put them, you know, keep them aligned with the program and keep them on the same line.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of challenges with this position, yeah. And especially with the shift back and forth.
And I agree.
But My one of my questions that I had I thought would be very important to talk about was a paradigm shift during your career where you thought maybe like where you understood that there's levels to this, you know, because I had that obviously, and I'm not talking about like first, second division level or levels of talent, because that's obvious that there's a difference, but in terms of depth to the game, in terms of the depth understanding of the profession, when did the paradigm shift occur? Was like, aha, that there's a lot more that I should, you know, embrace, and I should know more and learn more in order to be the best head coach possible.
Well, there are probably two moments. The first is related to the opportunity to visit the United States. In 1981, I was in my second year in Mestre, and I was fluent in English back then. And if you want, we'll go back to that after. For whatever reason, I was 22, and I was I was speaking very good English. And that helped me a lot in my profession because the head coach, who eventually took me as his assistant in Udine, that year he planned a trip to the United States. We had a player a former player of the Atlanta Hawks, John Brown. And this John Brown, who had played for years in the NBA, he was a power forward with a great shot. He had been coached by Hubie Brown, Cotton Fitzsimmons, Norm Stewart at the University of Missouri, and John McLeod. So he offered my head coach, to set up one-on-one meetings with all his former coaches. Unbelievable. So the coach, who was not speaking great English, says, "Listen, Ettore, if you buy your own plane ticket, I'll take care of you once we are in the States. You know, the hotel will share the hotel room. I'll pay you all the meals." Imagine, we were all amateur back then. Okay.
Yeah.
So with my savings, I bought my own plane tickets to go with them. And we spent 15 days in America.
Wow.
Starting with in Kansas City, where John Brown was living. And we met in Atlanta, in Phoenix, all his former coaches. And so I met, for example, Hubie Brown. Hubie Brown, I had listened to him giving lectures at the Eurobasket in Italy in 1979. So 1979, I listened to him doing the clinic at this Eurobasket, and he shocked me the first day. His lecture was 2 hours about terminology. He talked about terminology, you know, why it's important to have a clear terminology. So when you say catch the ball at the elbow, the players know what it means, or free throw line extender, or we hedge instead of help and recover, whatever it was. So for first time that somebody pointed me out how important it is to have a terminology. And the fact that I will find that 30 years later, 20 years later, that in the NBA, every team, because of the head coach they have different terminology, which is quite common among the old teams, but there are some major differences. Okay? And you live that when we worked together in CSKA. There were you from Lithuania, Dima Shakulin from Russia, myself, Italian, Quinn Snyder from America. So we had to find out a common terminology that we could share among ourselves and the players. So that's just a small example. But that trip, when I met all these top coaches, I felt like I was zero. So I felt, hey, we're going to, you know. And the thing that hit me was that they were super high, not that much in terms of strategy, but in terms of teaching, you know, teaching the fundamentals, teaching the detail, organizing a practice. Or it was not the fancy side out of bounds play or the fancy two guards offense. Forget that. They were teaching, and they had a progression. And that's where I started understanding, hey, I gotta make sure that my teaching method, meaning the progression and the way I try to transfer my, let's call it, knowledge to my players, is certified. You know, there is a system. First time. Then, much later, fast forward between the December 92 and the July 97, I was the head coach of our national team. And great time of my life because I was young, but we put together a great program. My first Eurobasket, we got out in the preliminary round after 4 years, putting basically all the under 20 national team that was silver medal in the world. After 4 years, we got the silver medal in Barcelona. And I say that because it's one of the things that gave me more, let's say, happiness to see this program move on. Okay. But in those, as you know, when you are working full time for a national team, you have a lot of free time. And I use all my free time to visit all the top coaches in Italy and Europe to go see their practices. And I mean, most of them, starting with Ivkovic, who was in those years in Olympiacos, I think, to other coaches in Italy. You know, it was amazing. It was an amazing learning experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and even now to see all these great coaches how they were relating to the players, how they were running practice, how they organized the practice, how they prepare a game, you know, different styles, different personality. That opened my mind a lot. And then final step was when I went to the NBA with a lot of, preconcept. Like in the NBA, they don't do anything all day. They just play the game, and the game is easy. And I had to open up my eyes because I see how hard they work individually, mm-hmm. how hard they work to prepare themselves, how hard and demanding is the season of them, how quick are all the coaches in the NBA to take decisions. They are very well prepared, amazingly prepared, because the game goes so fast. How good, I would say, most of the assistants in the NBA are in terms of X, O's, attention to details, ability to teach. I mean, that's another world. It's honestly another world. I thought it was not like that. I thought that we were so good in Europe, like coaches and players and organization, that we had nothing to envy to the NBA. Well, that was really,
eye-opening.
It was eye-opening, a learning experience. I've seen so many assistant coaches that are so good that I've been impressed. And then I was lucky enough to experience the opportunity to be a head coach in games there when Coach Pop was not there. Believe me, the game is so quick that you as a coach have to think so fast and matchups, calls, timeouts, and this. I mean, it's really demanding, really demanding.
You basically have to see things before they happen. You have to anticipate all the time. And at the highest level, with the highest level of athletes, that's the most difficult part, I think, of that profession at that level.
Agree with you, yeah.
And just to finish up the first quarter here, before we head on to my favorite topic, communication, looking back at your career and all the wins, all the highs, the experience of winning is second to none. You can't find it anywhere else in the regular life, I think. Besides maybe in a family when the son or daughter is born.
Sure.
I've heard that.
Not even to compare.
Yeah, that's a different realm. But in terms of losses, though, if you look back, the lessons learned, I think, from losses are much more valuable, or can be much more valuable when you're reflecting properly. And Tim Ferriss, I don't know if you heard of Tim Ferriss. He's an entrepreneur, a very famous podcaster, and he calls it favorite failure. So what would be your favorite failure that you reflect on and you can say that you can carry an important lesson from that on?
Well, it's too easy, all of them. I'm a very poor loser, sore loser. Mm. I don't lose well. I don't, honestly, in the short term, I don't see all the benefit of losing. Losing is painful. And you got to be very, very, let's say, mature to understand that there is a learning in that. Probably I learned to be a little bit more patient in my years in the NBA. And even now with this tough schedule that we have in Europe, where of course you can't overthink a loss, because after 48 hours you have another game. But honestly, I agree with you in terms of theory, but to put that in action, I still have a hard time to see. But still, I recognize one thing, that during the year, you need to have some of those losses earned, and you don't pay a too high price in terms of standings, you know? Mm-hmm. And that happens only to those teams who are on top. They are on top, they play consistently, so now they can afford once in a while a loss that gives them something, you know? But if you are in the middle of the pack, every loss is a problem.
Yes. I agree with you. I think there are certain parts, I think, that with the discussions that you have with your staff, obviously you break down and you analyze to death.
Sure.
But in general, losing is always tough, and it's hard to handle either way.
Yeah.
If we talk
losing
about
with the national team, losing with the national team is the worst, because when you lose with the national team, most of the time you end the possibility to compete. It's over. You go back home. you are eliminated from the competition. There is no tomorrow. That's awful. While most of the times, unless you are in the playoffs, you lose with a club, you still have a game tomorrow. You still have something to prepare for. In the national team, it's ugly. You might not see your team, your players for 4 months after that loss. So even if you learn, there is nothing you can share for about 4 months. And that's really ugly, honestly.
Yeah, that's, I can relate to that 100%. Losing in Lithuania and coming back to Lithuania, well, you try not to lose face, but it's difficult to deal with it for the whole nation. So,
sure.
If we talk about communication, I don't have a buzzer to go into the second quarter, so we just have.
Don't worry, we're in the support.
If without naming names and without naming teams. Because for me, it's probably would have more repercussions than for you. But this podcast is not about names. It's not about teams. It's about just certain topics that are applicable to coaching life. Mm-hmm. In terms of hard conversations that you had in the past, because as a head coach, I'm sure you had plenty of them. Is there one conversation where you think you still think back today, whether it was with management, with a staff member or a player, that you learned from a lot and you can still carry the lessons from that today?
Well, I learn a lot from a player every time I talk to a player. I tell you why. I was not a player. As you know, I stopped playing when I was 17. So I do not know anything about how they feel before a big game, how they feel in the locker room, how they can develop their trust among themselves. I can see them. I can study them. I can, let's say, help them to become closer. But what they feel inside, what a champion feels inside, you know, I've always studied all those great players that I've been lucky to coach in Europe, in America. I try to reveal everything possible, because there are so many different styles of leadership. There are so many different styles of being a pro player, of being a top athlete, of being, you know, Kobe Bryant is different from Tim Duncan, and his team is different from Manu, and Manu is different from Pau Gasol, and Pau Gasol is different from Sasha Danilovic, and again. And I've seen so many of them, and I could not share anything with them. So every conversation for me was very, very important. And even now in Milano, I have so many great players, but even those who are not great players, and just because they are players and they leave the locker room and they leave the pregame and during the game and after the game, and it's a learning experience every time. Now, I think the most difficult conversation you have with a player is when you cut him from the national team. That's awful, honestly, because most of the times those players have worked maybe all summer to make it to the final roster for the competition. And another one is difficult conversation is when you need to help a player that because of his age is no more what he used to be, and he cannot see that. And he still thinks that he's the same player of 5 years earlier. And now you need to make him understand that the reason why he's not playing is that because he's no more himself. It's different. Yeah. It's over. And you need to help him to do the reality check. And the reality check is not only putting that guy on the bench, which is already hard for every coach, but also to help him understand. Help him understand that life is going by, that father time is asking his tool, most of the play. And this is difficult because when you do professional sports as a coach, you are in an environment, the fans that see those players who are declining, they keep seeing them like when they were 28.
It's like
if they are under drugs, they don't see that. And they always dream that there is a coach smarter than you that can make that player play in the same way that he played when he was younger. And it can't happen. It can't happen. If you see historically, very, very few players have, handled their, Sunset Boulevard in a good way. It's always been painful, and it's always left scars on the coaches that were coaching them, on the players themselves, because that's the way it is, you know. You know, so those conversations are very, very difficult, I think.
I can say, I think that one guy comes always to mind when I have these conversations was Šiška, who retired. Maybe he could have even played a couple more years, you know, where he was right at that.
I begged him. I signed for CSKA. And if you remember, we had CSKA and we had Kirilenko and we had Šved. And after 30 days, Šved, who was a free agent, left. Kirilenko retired. And CSKA retired. I begged CSKA, I remember, to keep playing. Or another one is Saša Danilović. Saša Danilović, when he was 30.
Wow.
30 years old. And he had two more years in his contract with Bologna. He called me at night after the only practice he had in preseason after coming back from the Olympics in Sydney. And he told him, I'm done.
Wow.
I'm done. He was 30 with two more years. And by the way, that opened the way to Manu Ginobili. Mm. He became our starter. So think about coincidence. Think about, you know, how strange is life.
But sliding doors.
That's exactly right. But Saša could have played easily. Well, he had to play probably through injuries because he was injury prone back in that moment. But he has so much, let's say, charisma and personality that probably he could not accept the fact that he could have not been the real Saša Danilović because of his injuries. So he gave up money, he gave up everything just to walk away when he was still in his prime. Michel Platini in soccer, he did the same thing. At one point he said, that's it, I'm gone. Very few players do that. Most of the players, because they love basketball, they love the sport, they love being the guy, they want to try until they are, you know, they cannot even move.
Yes.
It's difficult.
When you go back and you had those conversations with particular players, whether it was their initiation or your initiation, did you have a way of preparing for those? Did you have your certain techniques or certain words that you carefully chose? Because there's a lot about, you know, certain speeches that you give and certain conversations that you have that you can prepare and you know which words to choose. Or was it just gut and intuition that you used to have those conversations?
I always try to be as honest and straightforward as I could be. I never try to sugarcoat anything. I think players are very intelligent. Players understand. Players have a lot of, you know, empathy, and you have to give them the same empathy if you can. I think.
Yeah.
I think it's you can prepare yourself, meaning that you can choose the words, you can use maybe examples, you can, you know, find a way to connect. But I think that honesty is the most important thing. I've always been impressed by for what I know, it was Gandhi, definition of integrity. Mahatma Gandhi's definition of integrity is when you align what you think with what you say and what you do, which is pretty, you know, impressive, because that means that, unfortunately, a lot of times, for whatever reason, we think one way, but we say something which is not related to what we were thinking. And sometimes we, even worse, we behave different from what we said or what we were thinking.
Yeah.
It's very hard to align thinking, speaking, and behaving. I think that that's a huge, huge challenge, but that's where we have to tend, I think.
One of the biggest attributes of coaching, I think, is that you have to absolutely avoid to be a hypocrite, because players like look through it straight away, and they appreciate honesty, and they appreciate that you talk walk the walk.
let me interrupt you for a second. They appreciate the truth, but sometime not at the same moment.
Reflection.
Deliver the truth. Sometimes it takes a lot of time for them to, you know, understand that what you told them was the truth. It's not easy. It's not, definitely not easy.
Yeah, it takes time sometimes to digest it, and the ego won't allow to you know, to look through it right away. It has to sicker through, I think. To look back just shortly for your time in the NBA before coming back to be a head coach again, you went through the head coaching interview process in the NBA. And I've never actually, like, now that I look back on, I never talked to anybody about that process and how it went about. How did you prepare? And after preparing and going through the process, were there one or two questions that you still remember today that were like, man, that was really good thought through and really good, well thought out? Again, without naming names or teams, with just general facts.
Well, right now, there is nothing that hit my mind. What I can tell you is that every time I went to an interview, and some of them were also the final rounds of the interview, I always have my a booklet with everything, you know, in terms of the way I analyzed the roster, the way I analyzed their franchise, the way I analyzed their future, and in terms of, so, and I had a group of people that always helped me in terms of, you know, put together the analytics, mm-hmm. you know, for that. So put together the numbers, put together, study the efficiency of every player, of every, I think honestly, it was a very, very well done book, you know, and there was also pointing out where I thought there could have been made improvements, you know, and what I thought was good to maintain and done before. I've had a conversation even with some owner when in those situations where I managed to get to the final round. Unfortunately, I always lost the final round, otherwise I wouldn't be here. But I think that the most interesting thing was always to see how they were relating to the fact that they were talking with a foreigner. So what always attracted me and interested me was to see how they were handling, on one side, the fact that they were somehow intrigued by the idea to have you as a coach, and on the other one, the concern of how you could have been welcomed by their players, being a foreigner. So that was the interesting part for me. And especially, you know, the, where relationships are very, very important. And, you know, you need to have the trust, you know, of the players of that club. That was the most interesting part. And, of course, I had, I remember, you know, players talk. So, of course, the players from the Spurs always helped me in every recruiting process. Coach Pop, RC Buford, they always helped me. So if I got very close to that, it was because people helped me even that time, you know. So I that was, but going back to your question, to see how they were handling the interest for you as a coach and as a person, but a little bit of, you know, resistance / concern / curiosity to see how the foreigner could handle that.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah, the dynamics are different, obviously, because of the international process. But in terms, when you look back now, we said knowing the players and communicating with the players and the players standing up for you, how has the communication changed with the players over the course of the last years, I mean, decades? Yeah, what did you notice in terms of how they absorb information? Is there a lack of, let's say, volume of information they can attain and retain during the game? Have you noticed the difference between the generations over the years of how much information they can absorb and the attention span they have?
That's interesting. First of all, if I say that I notice a difference, it has to be understood in the correct way. Let me make an example. If I compare my son Filippo, who's 16, to myself when I was a student, completely different attention span, completely different way to communicate, completely different way to focus. And I'm not saying that I was better than him or he's better than me. It's just different.
Yeah.
Filippo communicates much more quickly using WhatsApp, Twitter, Instagram. He's more used to visualize, while I was used more to write. You know, mm-hmm. I was taking notes. I still have hundreds of books that I wrote of notes at lesson. Now completely different. Okay. So, in the same token, my players of 30 years ago could handle, I don't know, a 45 minutes video session. Today, I cannot handle such a long session as a coach. After 10 minutes, I'm done.
Yeah.
I mean, I need and working with Coach Pop, I've seen Coach Pop doing mini meeting with one clip to show the players. But that clip was the result of a lot of hours of meeting among the coaches to understand what was the real, let's say, the most important thing that we need to focus for the players, and which was the most the clearest clip of our last two games to make the point. And then what we were doing after showing them the clip, what coach was telling them, and what we were doing in practice right after.
That was
an amazing work of, you know, synthesis, you know,
yep.
or picking your spots. When I was coaching 30 years ago, I could run a video session 1 hour and probably say so many things that most of them were going unperceived. And still I was making the point of those two, three things that were very, very important, you know,
but with
a lot of work. Now to, you know, pick your spot, select, be more, you know, efficient.
Filter.
That's exactly right. That's what you need. And also, think about that. When I was going to school, from primary, middle, high school, college, everything was written test or oral examination. An oral examination, you had to be able to entertain, to talk, to present, to answer questions. And blah, and blah, and blah, and blah. Here, most of it is multiple choice. Most of it is a test on a film. And boom, 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 boom. Completely different.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay? Now, an emoticon says more than 10 words. So it's not that it's better or worse. It's different.
Mm-hmm.
So I get surprised that once in a while, I send a watch to my players. Just to tell, hey, you know what? You had a great game today.
Yeah.
You were boom, boom, boom. Or sometimes, hey, was not your best night, but keep working. Everything will be okay. Or maybe I send them a clip. Or maybe I see something that I would like to share with them, not about basketball. Boom, I send them a little message. Back then, it was necessary a meeting all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah.
But that's so exciting, believe me, because you, being older, learn how to relate with younger people and how you can get their attention, which is extremely rewarding when you feel you made it and you got their attention.
Yeah, I think finding the connection with the player in on new terms and adjusting. I mean, there's something that I want to talk about later, is adapt or die mentality. And you either adapt or you're just going to fade out. So I think it's a big strength of a coach to be able to adapt and then prioritize of how to communicate. But curious.
There's another thing. Uh-huh. Dennis, there is another thing. You cannot misinterpret and think that you have a better communication if you kiss their ass.
No, yeah.
And unfortunately, I see this still a problem. A lot of people, and I see, and I've seen a lot of this. They think that becoming closer to the players, they are doing them a favor. I think that you help them if you ask them to. If you challenge them to become better, unfortunately, that does not happen all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Just curious, how many WhatsApp messages do you have a day these days?
Depends. When you lose, not a lot. When you win, a lot.
Okay. Just in third quarter, I don't want to make the third quarter too long. It's about philosophy. It's not too esoteric, I hope, but I also like the philosophical part. And we have a lot of conversations about different things that are philosophy related. But one thing that I always think about is purpose. And it feels like you have a purpose driven life. And also you try to instill that into your players to have a purpose driven mentality on the court, you know, the coaching, coaching them with a purpose-driven mentality. How do you correlate those two, life and basketball, with the word purpose? And how do you go about instilling that into the players?
I, you know, not instill nothing. And you will be probably laughing at this, but one thing that has gone through all my life and also my career. I really, and I'm not joking. Sometimes I'm still surprised they listen to me. My challenge, my inner challenge, has always been to develop a situation that my players trust me and listen to me. Not necessarily to do exactly what I ask them, but at least to, you know, they think that what I'm telling them might be interesting or useful to them, you know. The other thing, and I don't have a, as you will know, I don't have a good character, meaning that I don't have enough patience. And one of the biggest quality of a teacher should be the patience. And I've never had the patience. I've never had the patience with myself. And as a consequence, I don't have the patience with my players. I don't have enough patience. Probably I'm a little bit better now than 10 years ago. And 10 years ago, I was a little bit better than 20 years ago. But so one said that sometimes I'm still grateful that they still show, let's say, some kind of, let's call it appreciation or whatever you want to call it to me, that my players show them that. And I'm grateful to them. At the same time, because I would like to be the best possible coach every day. And I think I take the losses very bad because I think that I could have done something to prevent that loss. I think the players just respect that. And you know, they share the same thing. And most important thing, you don't change them. That's one of the biggest lessons I learned from Coach Pop. And you as a coach know very well that in all of us, there is an idea that we could do a better job than another colleague with a player. That player didn't play very well for Benas. I have a feel that if we get him, we'll make it play better here. You know, is that arrogance? Is that ego? Is that naive that you can do better? I don't know. Coach Pop, one of the very first things he told me was, you cannot change them. They are who you are, who they are. So if they didn't play well for Coach Riley or Coach Stevens or whatever, or if they didn't behave well, they're not behaving better because they come here and because I coach them. So I don't take a chance. Yeah. So What is the bottom line? Bottom line is that if you get players that as human beings, you share the same vision, the same values, the same, you know, concept, there is a higher chance you can do well. If you pick players that for whatever reason, they think different or they have different values, still respectful or whatever, things don't work. Simple like that. And so the best you can do is that you can try to be consistent, try to be honest, try to be straightforward, try to be, to show, let's say, equality. When I mean equality, I mean, that's very big to me, that to the same behavior correspond the same reaction independently from who you are. Because the worst thing is that you can have is treat people different depending on their status as player. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And in all organization, there is always a great dilemma, which is, in this organization, people with more skills are expected to have more responsibilities, or just because they have the talent, they can take shortcuts because we hope that their talent will let us win. That's always been the history of all organizations, in sports, in life, in business, in whatever. So as long as I am the coach, if you are the best, I expect from you the most. And sometimes people don't agree with it, with that.
Mm.
And I'm, you know, so if you think different from me in that specific thing, you have a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. But also, like, there can't be, like you're saying, there can't be special treatment with the best player. You expect the most out of him, but he's not going to get any slack because of that. And there's not going to be a double standard for the best player. It's going to be same rules apply to everybody. It's just the expectation on the court are a little bit different. Do I understand correct?
Yeah, but even I'm not saying that everybody, I mean, the great player that plays 35 minutes in a game, he deserves to rest probably the day after. Yeah. You cannot expect him to come to practice and have a hard practice.
Yeah.
So standards in practice, but what I expect is that in terms of, you know, thinking team, in terms of accepting criticism, in terms of taking responsibility and taking ownership for your, you know, I think that's the same for everybody.
Yeah.
Then
yeah.
The load, the workload, how many shots you take, blah, 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 blah. You know, if there is a rule that when we miss, we got to sprint back as soon as we can, as fast as we can, to prevent the transition layup. I mean, if you are the best player, you can walk back.
No.
So just sprint back. You know, it's simple like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Coach Pop, and I'm sorry that I always refer to him, but he's the best. And he always says something, and he says that not for free. He says that he's grateful to the players that let him be himself and coach them the way he thinks he should coach them, you know? Because sometimes players don't let you be yourself, because as soon as you start, you know, screaming for an awkward mistake, they take it personally.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So what?
Yeah, it's a blessing when you can be yourself, and you should be yourself, because your authentic self is the most important thing to be as a coach, because you don't want to be somebody else as a coach.
That you as a player will determine what kind of coach I can be for you. And you can help me being a very good coach for you, or you can help me to become a bad coach for you. And it's vice versa.
Yeah.
I can help you to be a very good player for us, or I can make it complicated for you to be a good player. So we got to find a way that we understand each other. And and it goes down to how we assume that the relationship should be lead. You know, relationship with the coach, relationship with the teammate, and things like that.
Yeah.
Sometimes it happens. It happens naturally. Sometimes can be a little bit, you know, helped. Sometimes it doesn't happen. Simply like that, it doesn't happen. There are seasons where, you know, the chemistry is not there, and you can have as many dinners as you want, and it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those dynamics you can't always control, but we always think about how we can control them, and we tend to overthink also a lot. I am certainly one of those people that likes to think and overthink and think deep. But when is there a time where you say, this is the decision, this is how it's going to be made, and how, like, the point I'm getting to, how much of that is your gut and intuition that's telling you that this is going to be the decision, rather than calculation and thinking back and forth, debating with yourself, with your staff? When does the gut say this is it, or is it your gut?
I think there is a lot of gut feeling, I think. And this might sound strange to you, because I told you I was not a player. I was not a player, and I had a very fortunate career, and it would be stupid if I lie on that. At the same time, I think I have a lot of weaknesses, but I've had one thing that helped me in this life as a coach and as a person. I think that all of us, we understand when a player is playing with his teammates and when he's not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can see, you can feel if somebody is into it or not, if somebody is engaged or not. So when I start feeling that that's not the situation, now decisions are already taken.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I don't think I the worst that happens when you go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. You know, at the end, the players want a decision. You want a decision. The environment wants a decision. So it's better to take a decision.
I think it's easier during the game to take that decision because you're forced to think quicker and decide quicker when it's between games or before practices, where you have time to think and to talk and to discuss. So in the games, the pressure of the time and pressure of the decision is much easier to take, whatever the decision is.
I think so. Yeah, sure.
Fourth quarter here, and it's going to be a basketball. She would fire me too, probably. The fourth quarter is about basketball specifically. First of all, staff, how do you go about building your staff? What do you look for in your staff? And what do you expect from your staff, whether it's during the game, during practice, or off the court? What are the values you look for in your staff and your expectations from them?
Ability to argue. I don't need to sit down and have no discussion. It's not easy. It's not easy to work with me for whatever reason. People sometimes are a little bit intimidated, not because of you, but because of the career. You know, like I always joke about General Popov. Like if the imaginary Russian general with all the
medals.
I mean, yeah, the medals and whatever, but the medals are important, but that's not. So I need somebody, I need to be challenged on tactical issues, preparation.
Yep.
And I need to be challenged. And if you're not ready to fight, that's the problem.
I learned that the hard way. But I grew from that. That was good. That was good.
I'm glad you say that. I need you to have as an assistant the ability to separate the obvious from the non-obvious. And I need you to use my energy for the non-obvious. If I need to spend energy to discuss something which is obvious, we're already on the wrong side. I need your energy because I sometimes I'm exhausted and I need your energy. I need your ability to understand how you can counter my mood. And that's the most important part.
Yeah.
Because I'm moody and I need you to, counter that.
Balance it out.
Yes. 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 On the other end, what I can guarantee you is that I will never use you to create a triangle to communicate with the players.
Mm-hmm.
And if I trust you, you can talk to the players and whatever you talk, I trust that you will let me know what is important for me to know.
Mm-hmm.
And you will keep for yourself what you think is important for you to keep for yourself. Sometimes, even in business, in companies, assistants or people are used to, get some information, create triangle.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
that's
yeah.
That's the worst in terms of communication in any group. People have to feel free to decide, but now you need to be smart and intelligent and have empathy to understand what is good for me to know and what is not good for me tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because that way you will have me and you will have the play, you will help the player. You know, and so it's not easy. It's not easy. But those, all this goes down the label of loyalty. No, because loyalty most of the times is misinterpreted. It's like if a player says, "Ah, coach, he fucked up this, he fucked up that." You go there, say, "No, don't say that. That's not loyalty. That's actor studio." You know, loyalty is the ability when you communicate with a player to understand what is important to let the head coach know in order to build a better trust between the players. And sometimes what is absolutely important, you keep it for yourself to help the players not get in trouble, to help the players understand that he was maybe wrong.
Yeah.
And you don't need to involve the head coach in this and create bad relationship. You know, it's a huge job. Huge professionally, it's a huge job. That's why great assistants are so valuable. So valuable. Then of course you can have an assistant who is better during the game because he sees things quickly, whatever. Somebody else is some other assistant in terms of basketball is better in planning the game. I mean, that's not a big deal. I mean, I'm lucky if I can find a person who understands what's going on in the team in terms of chemistry, relationship,
empathy,
whatever. That's huge.
Yeah, that's one thing. As when I started to become an assistant and I started going to that role and I started understanding when my paradigm shift happened was when I started to understand these dynamics, because those are the most challenging to understand, what to filter, what not to filter. And I've seen and I know assistant coaches who halted or not ruined their career because they're still young, but they put themselves in trouble where they didn't have a good filter and they didn't know what to bring back, and it just backfired. And it's a very underrated skill to know that, and the players don't forget that either.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of discussions these days with the staff, we talked a lot about pick and roll, whether it's offensive spacing or how to defend the pick and roll. It was probably 90% of our discussions. Is that still the case, or is the game? Are the discussions shifting towards a different direction, more or less?
I'm personally trying to go away a little bit more from pick and roll. You know, and as you see, I think in the EuroLeague this year, you see more post-ups, you see more exit for shooters. You see, I think that right now, defending and attacking the switches is becoming a major topic of conversation, and matchups, you know, lineups and matchups. That's very NBA. In the NBA, for sure, pick and roll was one of the major topic of conversation, but matchups and rotation was huge, huge. The NBA is also different because there is an unwritten rule that some moments of the game, both teams play with their second unit because the game is 48 minutes. Here, you can pull people out early and bring it back very soon because it's 40 minutes. At the end, the top player can play between 30 and 35. Basically, he has played all game. While in the NBA, still there are 13 minutes, even if you play top player 35 minutes. Okay, those at least 10 to 12 minutes are played by the second unit. But overall, matchups and lineups is becoming pretty big here, even here.
I think lineups in terms of like if you start switching a lot or if the other team is switching a lot, the lineup is much more important because of the matchups then are, you know, like you would have to have a whole lineup that's able to either attack switches or to switch. So I think that's a very valuable discussion also in the NBA these days. I think we see that a lot on a different level. Finishing up with your intense schedule, with your high pressure life and high pressure performance, the balance on your game day and the routines you have, is there a certain thing that you go through, a certain routine that you go to on game day? Because I know you have to maintain a certain frequency to manage your focus, to manage your anticipation of the game. What do you do on game day to maintain that frequency, and how do you go about to transfer that to the players?
Game day is always the same. I try to have a workout early in the morning because I think that sweating and doing something just clears my mind. You know, mm-hmm. I think it helps you. When you're lucky, you can have a physical workout that helps you. And then we have shoot around, and then I think the day of the game, different from what I did until a few years ago, where if you remember when we were in CSKA, we were having a little video session at the snack before the game. You know, I don't do that anymore. I just finish the preparation with the team in the morning at shoot around. Mm-hmm. And after that, I leave them alone. And maybe the assistants, they go with some individual clips in the locker room just to refresh to those who need that. But I don't want to, I try to have them a little bit more calm heading to the game rather than, you know, keep meeting. And I think that's not good.
Yeah. No, it's
personally, I need to have a little bit of, you know, physical activity where my brain is off, you know, and yeah. Just go. Yeah. Yeah.
So to finish off, this is going to be historic because I'm going to read you a line of Alex Ferguson's book. So Benas is reading a book to Coach Messina. And it's, please don't fall asleep on me. It's not to fall asleep. But it's more about Alex Ferguson's ability to find balance in terms of after the game and switch off. So he was into horse. He started to get into horse riding and horses and horse races. So a woman said to me at a Haydock races one day in 2010, "I see you on the television and you're so serious, yet here you are laughing and enjoying yourself." I told her, "Well, do you not want me to be serious at work? My job is about concentration. Everything that goes on in my brain has to be beneficial to the players. I cannot make mistakes. I don't take notes. I don't rely on video evidence, and I have to be right. It's a serious business, and I don't want to be making mistakes." He goes on to talk about the mistakes he made during games, but it's not more about the mistakes. It's more about, to me, the point I'm making about finding the balance and finding the balance between enjoying life and not being serious, but also respecting your profession and being serious. Where do you find and where can you be relaxed and enjoy maybe life with the family or anything else that you do?
I'm getting better here. For years, I let my mood depend on a win or a loss. Yep. And I'm not saying that this is not happening anymore. It still is like this. You win a game, you're happy. You lose a game, you're not happy. But, you know, when you think all you went through in terms of family, when you see things, going back to your first question, how people are struggling in this terrific time of the pandemic, you really understand what Coach Pop used to say. That's only basketball, you know.
Yeah.
And there are priorities and things that come before basketball. Once you have given everything you can, like Mr. Ferguson said, in terms of being professional, being ready, being focused. And once you've done that, okay, it's still a ball that is bouncing and rolling. And you cannot forget your friends, families, people that you really love, and they love you, not because you're a basketball coach.
I think that's the perfect way to end this, Coach. I appreciate your time. I had another note.
I really appreciate it. Please send me the link when you put this on the internet. I want to keep it for myself. You know how much I love you and respect you, and I'm grateful that we had a chance to talk like two friends today.
Yes, yeah. Yes, I will, and we'll make it public, and I'll send you. I made a note in the beginning of Renato because you talked about it, how he behaved himself, what values he carried, and the last thing I had was here: respect your work. That's the number one lesson I learned from you, and Renato sounded like the guy who respected his work. Yeah. So. Thanks again, and please tell your wife I'm sorry.
Love you. Take care, my friend.
Right. Love you too. Bye.
Bye-bye.